Sean, if you get blown up by a bomb, there's only bits left. And the police tried to take prints and so on of as many bits of us as they could, including our feet, to ensure that if we were blown to bits, that they might be able to recognise us.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is Dathi O'Kelly, former Irish diplomat who has served in Moscow, London, Belfast, Helsinki, Geneva and New York. He was closely involved with implementing the historic Anglo-Irish Agreement of 1985, a role which placed him and colleagues under serious threat from paramilitaries. In retirement, he has been director of the Institute for European Affairs and chair of the Press Council, and he's now chair of Innovate Ireland, that's a global talent development programme. His hobbies include fixing and driving vintage cars, through which he has a connection with Winston Churchill, and he's also a keen birdwatcher. Dathi, you're very welcome to the Insights podcast. I'm hoping we can talk to you about all of the above and also the state of the world right now, as well, indeed, as your daily visits to your wife, Antoinette, who's living with dementia. But let's go right back. To use that cliche, you weren't exactly born with a silver spoon in your mouth, were you?
No. My family, on both sides, my mother and my father, are both, the families are both from inner city Dublin, as indeed as my wife's family. My grandfather on my father's side was from Sheriff Street, and he got a job as a stoker on Trinity House, which is now Irish Lights. And my mother was brought up in two rooms over a shop in Parnell Street. Antoinette's grandmother was Rosie, the first queen of Moore Street, who had the stand closest to Henry Street. And her son, Antoinette's father, managed to pull himself up a little bit. He became a tailor, and then he became the chief cutter tailor for Irene Gilbert, who was one of those extraordinary designers that Ireland produced in the 50s and 60s.
And your father, what did he work at?
My father was a sheet metal worker in the Dublin Gas Company. So both Antoinette and myself were the first people in our families to go to secondary school. I was brought up in Glasthule, which is halfway between Dunleary and Dalkey, which is largely a working class area. Until I was 11, I lived in a two-room cottage in artisan's dwellings. My father had been brought up in another artisan's dwelling in Glasthule. And there were four boys. My mother had lost three girls. And there were four boys in the one room until we were 11. We had an outside loo. We didn't have a bathroom, but we used to go once a week to my uncle, who did have a bath.
And you lost three sisters. Was that a childbirth or how did that happen?
My mother lost her first two children. They were both girls, the first two. Her first child lasted until she was a year old and she got some sort of complication. It was during the war. The second girl died within a day. And then she had four boys, of whom I was the eldest. And then her last child was also a girl, but was stillborn.
There must have been a terrible sadness then for her, despite, I suppose, having four healthy sons.
I think people of that generation, they just got on with life. She always had a sadness within her. But when I got married, I was the first person to get married. She always saw Antoinette as her daughter. And they had a very close personal sort of relationship. But there was, obviously, there was that sadness.
Did you meet Antoinette? Was that in college? You went to UCD?
We met when we were both 18. And we've been together ever since.
Fantastic. A real love story then. And did you meet in college?
We met in college, first year, yeah.
You were studying, I think it was history and Irish. Yeah.
And she was studying Irish and French, yeah. Yeah. And we've been together ever since, except for a six-month hiatus when I think I was a little bit too forward and she wasn't ready for it. And then, of course, you know, she's been in a home now for nearly 5 years and...
You started professionally, your professional life began in teaching. She was a teacher as well, of course.
Yeah, we were both school teachers. And she remained a school teacher all her life, until she didn't stop teaching school until I went to London as ambassador, when she had too many other things to do. She wasn't able to continue. I spent 2 years with the Christian Brothers in Dunleary, which is where I'd gone to school. And then we got married, and the day we got married, we went off to Africa. And we spent 3 years with the Irish Jesuits in Africa.
What was that like?
Wonderful. And they were extraordinary people. I'm not, as you know, I'm not particularly religious, but they really were the most extraordinary people. The Irish Christian Brothers, the Irish Jesuits, the various nursing sisters and teaching sisters. They had a great joy of life, and what they were really trying to do was the classic missionary. They were trying to improve the lives of those people with whom they worked and whom they touched. They were extraordinary people.
And you were teaching what? Was it English?
English and history.
And that was for what, about 2 years, you say?
No, almost three. Mm. And then we came back, and we got a bit of wanderlust at that stage. And I came back, and I spent 2 years teaching in Marian College in Paul's Bridge. But I had lots of friends in foreign affairs whom I'd met in university. And so I did the exam for third secretary. And I was 28 when I joined the department, which in those days was quite unusual.
And that then became your professional life right up to retirement. You lived in very interesting times. But you had a period, I think, initially in Moscow, just after we set up the embassy. That was when Gareth Fitzgerald was minister and we were expanding our footprint, so to speak. But then you found yourself in London. Were you the press officer in London?
The press officer, and also the person dealing with the political parties in Westminster.
In the mid to late 70s?
In very difficult times. I arrived there in November 77 to replace Dermot Gallagher, whom you knew, the late Dermot Gallagher. And I stayed there until the summer of 82, so almost 5 years. And it was the hunger strikes, the Falklands, the murder of Éireann Eve, who was a friend of mine, of course, because I used to meet him regularly, the murder of Mountbatten. It were very difficult times, and the relationship between London and Dublin was very bad. And successive Irish Taoiseach, Charles Haughey, Gareth Fitzgerald, people like Cardinal O'Fee, people like John Hume, all of them tried to persuade the British to change what they were doing in the prisons of Northern Ireland, which was totally counterproductive. It really was a very difficult time. And I think, in a way, that's Charlie tried to change it in his two summits with Mrs. Thatcher. And I think he got her to understand that there was an Irish dimension to this whole problem, that it just couldn't be solved within Northern Ireland alone. And you remember they discussed this totality of relationships in Ireland. So it was a time of great difficulty for successive Irish governments, both of whom were committed, both Taoiseachs were seriously committed to changing things and to building a better relationship with the British. But it was really very difficult in those days in London.
Tell me a little bit more about Éireann Eve. You say he was a personal friend.
He was. He was essentially a soldier. You may remember a movie called The Caldet Story about an escape. Well, that was written by Éireann Eve, who actually escaped, I think it was three times from camps in Germany, prisoner of war camps. And so his experience of the Second World War, possibly, I don't know, possibly the stance taken by Ireland in terms of neutrality during the Second World War, his experience in the war completely coloured his life. He was one of those who was left behind in Calais to try to prevent the Germans encircling the British army in Dunkirk. And that's where he was first captured. So he was a very strong unionist, but he was fundamentally a very decent man. There was a great decency about him. And he was very close to Thatcher, and there's no doubt, had he not been killed, had he not been murdered, actually.
By the INLA it was.
By the INLA. Extraordinary. They planted a bomb in his car in the underground car park of the House of Commons, and it had a mercury drip switch, and as he came up the ramp, the bomb went off, which says something about capacity of these organizations and something about the absence of security.
What was your own reaction to that atrocity?
Horrendous. I mean, I'm not a believer in the use of violence. I understand how people resort to violence, but I don't believe it gets us anywhere positive. What did it achieve other than an increasing dislike in Britain for some people in Ireland, and in a way more generally for the Irish themselves? I was there for almost 5 years in those very difficult days. I had family living in Birmingham when the pub bombs went off in the 70s. In many ways, the people who suffered most as a result of the Irish Republican campaign in Britain were the Irish living in Britain, and particularly the working class Irish living in places like Birmingham and London.
Of course, the position was further complicated by the Falklands War because of the position of the Irish government. Now, this followed on from the difficulties arising from maybe the over-egging of what was meant by the totality of relationships.
Yeah, I mean, Thatcher was very sensitive to Irish matters, security matters, Northern Ireland, and she was a very strong unionist. So there was a little bit of over-egging in Dublin on the totality, you know, of what might emerge. The Falklands was something different. The Falklands had been invaded by the Argentinians. It was a military government. It was not a nice government at all. The Irish government, as all the other governments in the then EEC, were supportive in a way of the British position. But both the Italians, because of the numbers of Italians living in Argentina, and the Irish, because of our military neutrality, there was no way that Italy and Ireland could go along with the British, particularly after the sinking of the Belgrano. The Italians, I think, were more sensitive than we were. They decided they couldn't go along with it, but they kept their mouths shut. What we did was that we tried within the United Nations, and Noel Doerr has written about this at length, we tried to find a way in which, within the framework of the United Nations, a solution could be found acceptable to both the British and the Argentinians. It's possible that some people in America were encouraging us to do this, but that drove the British nuts. And they didn't have a problem with the Italians. Their problem was that they saw us as interfering in their business. And the result in the UK was deeply distressing. I used to chair a meeting of the Irish bodies in the UK, you know, the Tourist Board, the IDA, Enterprise Ireland. We used to meet once a week. Irish business, Irish interests were suffering deeply in Britain as a result. I think the stand that we took did us a great deal of damage.
You then came back to Dublin. You were based in Dublin, but you did a lot of, you became one of what were known as the travellers going north.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, the relationship between Britain and Ireland when the Fine Gael Labour government came to power at the end of 82 was really very bad. Everybody in Ireland, including the opposition, including Fianna Fáil, realised that it had to improve, that the dangers of what was happening in the north, the emergence of Sinn Féin as a very, very serious political organisation, that there were real dangers, there were real threats to the interests of this state, not to mention the north. So it was necessary to do things. And the government had a three-pronged approach. Peter Barry was a very, very strong nationalist. And he was determined to try and do something to correct and ameliorate what he called the nationalist nightmare in Northern Ireland. The Travellers were involved in that. I'll come back to it in a moment. That was one issue. A second issue was that John Hume in particular, and also Garrett and Dick Spring, realised that the traditional nature of Irish nationalism and the traditional relatively simplistic aim of Irish nationalism had to be reformulated in such a way as to enable us to really engage in negotiations with the British. And so you got the New Ireland Forum, which effectively sought to modernise, if you wish, what was meant by Irish nationalism, what the aim of Irish nationalism was. And then the third element was to try and build up a working relationship with the British so that together with the British, we could both together address the problems in Northern Ireland. There were really two travellers, myself and the late Martin Burke, who travelled in the north. And we would spend 3-4 days a week in the north talking to anybody who would talk to us other than those who were engaged in violence. So that we built up a huge range of contacts right across society, political society, including, by the way, the DUP, civil society, the various NGOs and so on, but also school teachers, lawyers, priests, Protestant ministers and so on. And we would report on these things. We'd write them up, the same as you would as a journalist. And then our reports, or a number of them, would be circulated from time to time to various ministers and officials in Dublin.
The New Ireland Forum reported, I think, was it in 84? And
yeah.
There were basically three models put forward: unitary state, federation or confederation, or joint authority. Now, infamously, at a Chequers summit, or in the aftermath of a Chequers summit, Mrs. Thatcher blew them all out of the water. Out, 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 in summary. Now, did that ultimately work to the government, the Irish government's advantage, in the sense that she was persuaded that, look, she had made a terrible mess and needed to get into serious negotiation?
Absolutely. Well, to be fair, she had been engaged in serious negotiations. She had been engaged in serious negotiations for quite a long while. The negotiations that led up to the Anglo-Irish Agreement, I can't remember exactly how long they took, but at least two years. No, she had been engaged in serious negotiations. She had a reasonably good relationship with Garrett Fitzgerald. There's no doubt that she didn't wish to harm him. He was distraught. I was in the embassy at the time because she, I think, had given her press conference. It might have been in Chequers. And he hadn't heard about her press conference when he was giving his, but the journalists had. So he was absolutely distraught. And a number of politicians and civil servants just kept on saying, look, we've got to go on. And in fact, we may be able to use this. And Sean Donnellan in particular was very influential in the United States. And Reagan was persuaded to take matters up with her, which I think was in January, which would have been, say, 6-7 weeks or whatever after the outburst. And Reagan, who was, I won't say beholden, but who was very close to Tip O'Neill, and Tip O'Neill kept on raising this issue with him. He used to meet him once a week. Reagan apparently said to Thatcher, look, the two countries which I love the most are the United Kingdom and Ireland. And you've just got to get on together.
Tip O'Neill, of course, being Speaker at the time.
Exactly. Second most powerful politician in the United States. Yeah.
Yeah. So roll on then. You had the Anglo-Irish Agreement pretty quickly following on from that. It was before the end of the year. It was 1985 in November.
And it
fell short of all of the three options outlined in the forum report. But it did give the Irish government a foothold that was, I think, as Garrett Fitzgerald would have said, was more than consultative.
Oh, gosh, yes. We were concerned. The Irish government was concerned about overselling the agreement because there had been a massive unionist response, as you remember. Seamus Mallon used to say that you've got to sell it a bit better, you know, because keep the nationalists informed. It was unique, Sean. Here was a government, the government of the United Kingdom, welcoming in representatives of another government. And their job was to represent the concerns of the minority within Northern Ireland, of the nationalists within Northern Ireland. And the British government was under treaty obligation to make determined efforts to reach agreement. It's quite unique.
But there was a doubt, I think, right up to the end as to whether you were going to get strong support from nationalists for this agreement on the grounds of, like, did it go far enough? Seamus Mallon, you mentioned him there, he was a key figure in this. I mean, his support for this thing was crucial, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he didn't give his support until towards the very end. We used to meet with the SDLP very regularly to discuss the texts. And the texts, of course, were changing from time to time. And just before we finally agreed the texts, we had dinner in Ivy House, and the SDLP had they were allowed to read the text. They were never allowed to take it away. And over the dinner, Mallon said, he said about this agreement, he said, a horse is a horse and a camel is a horse designed by a committee. This is a horse. I'm giving it my support.
That was literally days before Hillsborough on the 15th of November.
It might have been a couple of weeks before, but it was quite soon before. Yeah.
And obviously the government must have been very pleased with that, because Mallon was seen, and he was very close to Charles Haughey, then leader of the opposition and leader of Fianna Fáil.
He was, and he was a very strong nationalist. Charles Haughey was very unhappy that Mallon had agreed to support the agreement.
And did Mallon give him advance warning he was going to support it?
Oh, he would have. He would have. It didn't come out of... Well, he did. I wouldn't think that he gave him advance warning. I think he would have told the government first. But he certainly would have made clear to Charles Haughey before the actual signature of the agreement that he was going to...
Had you a hand in making sure that Haughey was put on notice?
No, none whatsoever.
I think you yourself might have been referred to in some of the briefings given by Charles Haughey's spokesperson, PJ Mara. Explain that or tell me about it.
I think Haughey must have been very disappointed that that Mallon had decided to support the government position. And in fact, he never spoke to Mallon again. And so PJ said to journalists, or some journalists, I think it was covered, if I remember. I think it might have been RT. I don't remember now. But he said that, you know, a civil servant in Dublin had been acting in a political way in Northern Ireland in a way that civil servants shouldn't do so. And that was me, of course, and it was in relation to Mallon. It caused me, I have to say, it caused me a little bit of concern at the time. And it caused me a little bit of concern, particularly when the government changed 2 years later in 87. But it was made very clear, very quickly, that I had nothing to fear.
Made clear by whom?
Fianna Fáil.
Interesting. So the agreement was signed, and it gave, as you say, or as you described, the Irish government an unprecedented right to make representations, put forward views and proposals. And there was an office set up in Belfast. You were very much part of that. It was known as the Bunker.
Yeah, it was a bunker. It was a converted office. It was a converted office space that had been, it had been the headquarters for Wimpy. When Wimpy were building the motorway. And so it was two stories, and it was built like a T. So the long, the top end of the T was divided between a British side and an Irish side. And on the top end of the T, we also had our dining quarters, our kitchens and so on. And then the long part, the bottom end of the T, was where the Irish side lived. So we lived in converted offices. We didn't have any curtains on the windows. There were armed policemen walking around the building 24 hours a day. We weren't allowed outside of the building. We travelled in Irish military aircraft from Baldonnell to the military airfield in Aldergrove outside Belfast. And then at the beginning, we travelled in British military helicopters from Aldergrove.
Tell me about life, just the ordinary practicalities of life in the bunker. You say you had no curtains. It was probably a fairly frugal existence. Maybe that your life growing up in Glastool with the outside loo perhaps had prepared you for maybe more than some of your colleagues.
Well, there were normally during the week, there were seven of us plus a cook. And we went in, once the thing steadied down, not for the first couple of months, but once it steadied down, we went in on a Monday and we came out on a Friday. And then we had a weekend crew went in for the weekend. We worked exceedingly hard. We worked very long hours. And we ate together. So we had our breakfast together, the breakfast not necessarily together, but lunch together and dinner together. There was never any alcohol until dinner time. Then there was probably a little bit too much in order to ease us off a little bit. We were blessed by the local staff. And the local staff were working class people from East Belfast, whose neighbours, of course, didn't know where they came from. And they came in, they worked for the Northern Ireland office. Now, people would have known that they worked for the Northern Ireland office, but they wouldn't have known that they worked in the bunker.
How carefully would they have been vetted by the RUC? Because
very.
You know, if they were treasonous.
Some of the drivers are drivers. In fact, both our drivers at the beginning were former RUC men. But the staff, the cleaning staff and the kitchen staff were decent, ordinary Protestants from East Belfast. There was a husband and his wife, and then the husband's sister. Her husband had been murdered by mistake by the loyalists. Their mother had been a Catholic, and she'd married their father, in 1929 and gone to live with them in East Belfast and become a Protestant. And he worked in the shipyards. He was the last person to be employed and the first person to be let go. And the two kids and their other siblings used to go and visit their Catholic grandmother in the falls every Sunday. And they'd be beaten up because they were Protestants. And when they would come back to East Belfast, they'd be beaten up again because they'd been to visit their Catholic grandmother.
It was an
awful society. And that is largely gone.
You also, I think, had a working assumption based on solid grounds that every word that you spoke to each other and all your communications were being carefully and accurately monitored by the British.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yeah. My first posting was in Moscow, where I learned to understand that anything that I used electronically was capable of being overheard or decrypted. So when we were in Belfast and we wanted them in particular to do something, we would translate it from English into Irish and then we would encrypt it and make it just a little bit more difficult for them to decrypt. But in all my career, and I've been very lucky, I've had a wonderful career, in all my career, I have always taken it for granted that anything I use, telephone, electronically, can be understood. And if I really want to do something, I would use this when I was in London, for example. If I really wanted to get something that I considered to be secret, I would handwrite it and send it with a courier.
You wouldn't even trust the old golf ball typewriter?
Gosh, no.
Good heavens. I happened to be up there on the day that Peter Barry arrived for the first time to Merrifield for a meeting of the he went up to Stormont Castle, but there was a march, I think, from the Shorts factory out to the gates of Merrifield, and they were coming along with noise and racket and flags and all the rest of it. And I was fairly relaxed about it until I saw a much more experienced colleague saying, run. And run we did, and for very good reason. I mean, there was a lot of violence or threatened violence on the part of protesters at Maryfield, where you were centred.
There were. We were lucky in the sense that the entrance to Maryfield was also the entrance to a depot repair shop for the RUC, for vehicles. So there were RUC vehicles going in and out all the time. And later, when we got to the stage where we actually were travelling in motor cars rather than helicopters, the protesters at the gate, and the protesters remained at the gate for a good year. The protesters at the gate, they couldn't discern who was in what car. So, and the RUC were exceedingly competent at protecting us. But I can remember early, and we went in on the 8th of December, 1985. And early in January, there was a march of 18,000 from Derry to Maryfield to get us out. And there were only two of us inside. It was a Saturday, Michael Ellis and myself. And it was absolutely terrifying. Because had we been pushed out, and we weren't pushed out, but had we been pushed out, we would have been pushed into Palace Barracks, which was behind us, which happened to be the headquarters of the UDR. And they were no friends of ours either. So it was a difficult time.
Before you went to Maryfield, before you left Ivy House, there were certain procedures that you had to go through, you and Michael Ellis in particular, to make sure that your identity would have been well established.
You know, Sean, if you get blown up by a bomb, there's only bits left. And the police tried to take prints and so on of as many bits of us as they could, including our feet, to ensure that if we were blown to the bits, that they might be able to recognise us.
That must have been quite a moment when you were asked to make your footprints available.
Yeah. There were other moments. I mean, both Michael's family and my family were under 24-hour police protection here because lots of people in the north knew where we lived. Michael actually moved house. I didn't. And I'll tell you a little funny story about it at one stage. So outside my house in Monkstown, there was, you know, you'll remember them, one of these wooden boxes with a policeman with a submachine gun inside 24 hours a day. There were 17 of them, by the way, in Dublin, 17 boxes. And many, many, many years later, I was introduced to the head of the Criminal Assets Bureau. And he said, sure, I know you. And I said, do you know me? He said, yes. He says, when I was a young rookie in Dunleary, I used to sit outside your house with a submachine gun.
Extraordinary. Speaking of police, you give the RUC high marks for the level of protection. And I think you found that the then chief constable, Jack Herman, was basically a friend of the Irish in the bunker.
Yes. I mean, look, he had a sense of duty. As indeed did people like Ken Bloomfield, who was the head of the Northern Ireland Civil Service, who, by the way, hated the agreement. But he felt it was his government's agreement and his duty was to implement
because
it.
Because the NIO had been shut out of the negotiations.
For British reasons, nothing to do with us, and we didn't know it. And he was very sore about it, and rightly, I would have been sore in his place. But he still had a sense of duty. But to go back to Herman... There was a lot more cooperation between the police on both sides of the border than people were prepared to say. And there was particularly a great deal of cooperation at an operational level, say between, you know, the Garda stations on the border and Garda stations and police stations on the other side of the border. And Herman certainly saw the agreement as a possibility of improving the relationship and the cooperation between the two police forces. And we were sort of ostracised when we went in. Who are these people coming in to tell us how to do our work and do our job and so on?
Ostracised by?
The Northern Ireland office and so on. And indeed the Northern Ireland Civil Service. But it was King, who was the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, and Herman used to come in quite regularly, who I think gave an example to the Northern Ireland Civil Service, gave an example to the Northern Ireland office. Yes, we're going to work with these people and we're going to try to prove
He was a good man to socialise, by all accounts.
Oh, he was great. He was wonderful. He, he was a Presbyterian, and his wife was dying of cancer. And he brought his wife down to Dublin to go on a pilgrimage in an Aer Lingus aircraft to Medjugorje. And he brought her back, and she died, I think, about 3 weeks afterwards. But he brought back a bottle of Slivovitz, and he brought it in to the bunker one night. He was having dinner, and we polished it.
And over time, did Bloomfield's approach, did that help improve relations with the NIO civil servants?
Yes. Bloomfield, who had a great sense of duty, he was head of the Northern Ireland civil service, as distinct from the Northern Ireland office, which is the British government. Bloomfield appointed a senior man in his small little cabinet to be the liaison person between the secretariat, that's ourselves, and the Northern Ireland Civil Service, so that very quickly we were able to organise meetings in the bunker of, for example, senior people in the Irish Department of Education, senior people in the Irish Department of Health, to meet with our opposite numbers in Northern Ireland, so as to do business together without political implications, just to improve cross-border cooperation. And it quickly became obvious to the Northern Ireland people, and indeed to the British, that we were actually serious in trying to improve things, and that we were not trying to take over, we were trying to work with.
But you were raising issues that would be described as grievances at the same time.
Oh, a lot of them, yes. Yeah. And we raised a lot of individual grievances, none of which, by the way, are in the public domain, for obvious reasons. Where you'd have people harassed by the UDR, or, and there were all sorts of harassment, or people having particularly difficulties in employment and so on. We would raise those issues. And we built up a thing called the log, where either side, if they had a problem, would register it in the log, and it would be regularly reviewed so that we could trace how problems that were raised were being dealt with or not being dealt with. And this, of course, gave both sides a handle on actually getting things done.
You were saying that Seamus Mallon would have liked to see the Irish government promote the agreement and the success of it maybe a bit more vigorously. But there must have been some, again, this kind of thing of zero-sum game and all that, that the unionists were so virulently opposed to it, to the point where they all resigned their seats in Parliament, which in turn had the benefit of giving Seamus Mallon a seat in Westminster.
Exactly.
That, in one sense, must have been very reassuring for the Nationalists, even though Fianna Fáil were dead against it, going to the point where Charlie Haughey sent Brian Lennon to the States to lobby against it, and he spoke trenchantly against it in the Dáil.
Yeah, there were lots of people in Fianna Fáil who were not in agreement with Charles Haughey. There were one or two of them came out publicly, as you know, and they left Fianna Fáil. There were quite a number of them, and they had been ministers and were to become ministers later on. And they've told me privately that they privately said to Haughey he was on the wrong track. But it became clear very quickly that the agreement was actually delivering, that the numbers of changes that the British were prepared to accept and do things differently became obvious. And the police began to take a different view towards loyalist violence than they had in the past. I mean, to give you an example of how it might work, Breed Rogers was in, I think, Lurgan or Portadown, one or the other, around about Easter time in 1985, when the place was being besieged by loyalists. And she was calling the Department of Foreign Affairs and conveying the information of what it was like inside. They were telling us, and we were telling the British. So it was quite, there was a very close working relationship in handling with these things. And it did become obvious to people on the ground in the north that there were changes, and particularly changes in the manner in which the UDR were dealing with Catholics.
Seamus Mallon, in an interview I did with him for the Irish Press during that election campaign, talked of the UDR and says anything to get those bastards off the road. But they seem to have cleaned up their act, or had their act cleaned up for them in some respects.
Oh, there's no doubt. If when eventually it will come out, and all these things will eventually come out. You know, first of all, they would say no, nothing happened, and then they'd be stood down until the thing was investigated, and then they couldn't go out without the RUC being present with them. So their capacity, and remember, the UDR were effectively a local militia. Their capacity to act as a local militia was seriously constrained over a period. And that became obvious to people. And eventually, I think there's a good deal of truth in this, eventually it provided the basis for John Hume to be able to persuade Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, look, there is another way of going about a Northern, about a united Ireland than violence.
You've just moved on to the topic of Hume Adams, where I think there was a lot of criticism of Hume, and that's putting it mildly. I mean, we can only think of the Sunday Independent during a certain period when he began to talk to Gerry Adams. But there was also, I think, a shift on the part of the Irish government, was there not, where there was a realisation in the early 90s that along with the Hume Adams, there was a willingness to maybe in low profile and perhaps plausibly deniable ways to engage with the representatives of Sinn Féin. We saw that, for instance, with Martin Manser, people like Dermot Hearn. Did that leave people like, say, Seamus Mallon and maybe yourself, who would have been close to him, somewhat disconcerted as to where this might lead?
I was away at the time, but you're absolutely right. I mean, it did become obvious over a period that there was another way. And I think that became obvious to people like Gerry Adams and people like Martin McGuinness. Father Alec Reid was central in all of this. And it's really a great pity that the late Martin Manser didn't get around to writing detailed memoirs, because he really played a central role in bringing everybody into the fold.
Could and should that have been done much earlier?
It couldn't have happened in 1985. It wouldn't have been possible. Not at all. There was no way.
Even through back channels?
I don't
Because the Brits were at it, were they not? This emerged later on.
The Brits were at it all the time. But they were only talking. There was no way that a British government could have a political party that had a military wing, active military wing. There was no way a British government could bring them into the fold. And even after the Humes-Adams talks and some of those extraordinary scenes with Albert Reynolds, do you remember when he held hands up and so on? Even after that, the British government found it very, very difficult, if you read Major's memoirs, for example, to bring Sinn Féin into the fold. And various obstacles were put in the way, things like decommissioning, which frankly didn't matter a damn in reality. It had a political reality, but in real reality it didn't matter. You could get rid of 1,000 guns today and buy 1,000 tomorrow. I mean, it wasn't an issue. But there was a change, but that change didn't come until, as you say, later on. But I don't think it would have happened without the success of the Anglo-Irish Agreement in dealing with the problems of the minority.
There was also an important speech, wasn't there, by Peter Brook, who was Secretary of State, where he spoke about the British having no selfish strategic or economic interest in Northern Ireland. That seems to have concentrated the minds, particularly of Sinn Féin.
Oh, yes. And that speech was drafted very carefully and drafted in conjunction with John Hume.
And I think subsequently incorporated into the Downing Street Declaration by Reynolds and Major.
And Major. And I mean, theirs is a very interesting relationship. They had built up a trust and an understanding. And that's what we were trying to do with the Anglo-Irish Agreement. They had built up a trust and an understanding when they were Minister for Finance and Chancellor of the Exchequer. Major came over to Reynolds' funeral. And
Didn't stop them knocking lumps out of each other in Dublin Castle at a famous summit.
Oh, no. Why not? But they, go back to where we started, when we were talking about what it was like in 1982, when there was absolutely no trust between the British and Irish governments. And then you get to a period, say in the early 90s, where you're in a completely different space. And then you get this extraordinary relationship between Bertie Ahern and Tony Blair. I've never seen a political relationship like it.
Where were you during that? Were you in London at the time as ambassador?
I was in charge of the Anglo-Irish division from 2000. And then I went to London as ambassador in 2001. And I was there until 2007. So I saw seven years of it. And we're incredibly close.
Now, but there was very much, and I suppose to this day it remains something of a stop-start arrangement. I mean, it took a long time to get the institutions of the Good Friday Agreement up and running. And they, you know, it was as much in the early days suspended as it was in session. And decommissioning didn't happen for, 7 years until 2005?
Yeah. And though there were very, very many difficulties. You had the big bank robbery, if you remember, in the north. You had the raid on the Sinn Féin offices in Stormont. You had the shooting, do you remember, of the McCartneys in the bar, and I think it was a Short Strand. There were many, many, many ups and downs. And in recent years, Brexit has been a really big difficulty because the ability to work very closely with the British government and the ability of the North and South to work together and so on was much easier when we were all within the EU than it is now.
Of course, Brussels was another point where a place where you could sort things out, and there was just that level of relationship there that was suddenly amputated.
And yes, and then you had an exceedingly nationalist government in London for 5-6 years, which made it very difficult to deal with.
You spoke, I think, at the McGill Summer School, even before Brexit was voted through, that this was going to present a serious challenge and a lot of problems for the peace and for Anglo-Irish relations. Now, to what extent have your concerns been allayed by the arrangements that followed on from it?
I think there are some difficulties now which are very serious and which probably would not exist in the same way as they do had Brexit not happened. For example, the relationship between the DUP and Sinn Féin is very fractured at present. Mm. There are great difficulties in the executive. The DUP, you know, took a view in favour of Brexit and they aligned themselves over those 5 or 6 very difficult years in the UK. You know, with the hardline Brexiteers and the Tory party. They align themselves with people like Boris Johnson. It's still quite fractured in the North. The executive is not working as well as it should.
Would it be fair to describe the executive as of now, as we speak in early 2026, as being not so much a power-sharing arrangement as a division of power arrangement?
Probably. No, I haven't given that any thought. The difficulty, as I see it, in the executive is to get the two sides to make decisions together for all of Northern Ireland. The big decisions that need to be taken are not being taken.
Such as?
Water, housing, health. And the DUP are in a very difficult political position given the support for Jim Allister's TUV.
And at the same time, you have demographic changes and you have people in Sinn Féin saying, and not just Sinn Féin, look, it's time to start a conversation about a border poll leading on to United Ireland.
Yeah, and...
And to make preparations.
Yeah. But the opinion polls, which are taken consistently in Northern Ireland, and they have been consistent, show no more than 30 to 33% of the population in favour of a united Ireland. The demographics are changing in the sense that the percentage of people of Catholic origin is increasing a little bit, and the percentage of Protestant origin is decreasing. This is particularly true in the middle classes because many, many Protestants are going to university in the UK, in Britain, and they don't come back. But there's nothing to indicate that there is a steady and strong movement towards a 50% plus one in favour of unity.
How secure is the peace in your view?
I think the peace is reasonably secure. I mean, you'll always have some dissident Republicans. There's always a possibility of a policeman being shot or killed or an army person being shot or killed. There are still problems on the loyalist side. But I don't think there's going to be a return to where it was.
Which is the great gift of the peace process and the various agreements. You can go to Belfast now on the train and get off and feel at ease. You can go and socialise. You can go visit Northern Ireland. And it's a very good place to visit. You don't have that feeling in your bones, look, the sooner I get across, back across the border, the safer and more relaxed I'll feel.
I'm afraid I still feel it.
Really?
Oh, my bones, yeah, and I was there quite recently. I was there in November. I go up regularly. Look, it is completely changed. I mean, Belfast is a European city now. I was staying in the hotel and I said to the receptionist, "Where are you from?" "I'm from Australia," she says. I mean, you know, that would not have happened 30 years ago. And it's completely changed. But it's my own experience. I don't have much hair, but the few hairs I have on the back of my neck sort of rise.
We've spent most of this conversation discussing your time, for obvious reasons, dealing with Anglo-Irish relations. But post your period as ambassador to London, you got involved in a very important piece of work with the United Nations to do with the cluster munitions.
Yeah. When Dermot O'Hearn visited South Lebanon in, I think, 2006 or 2007, he witnessed the extraordinary damage done to the farmland in South Lebanon by the misuse by the Israelis of cluster munitions. They had effectively contaminated the farmland. And you had kids and farmers and so on losing arms and limbs and whatever as these unexploded bomblets were left behind. And Dermot O'Hearn was determined to do something about it, as were others. And you couldn't do it within the UN system, because within the Conference on Disarmament, it operated on the basis of everybody had to agree. And of course, the Russians and the Americans and so on, and the Israelis and the Indians, they were not going to agree to outlaw cluster munitions. 85% of the non-nuclear armoury of the United States consisted of cluster munitions. They were a very, very important piece of equipment. And they were very dangerous. The Americans dropped them by the millions, for example, in Vietnam. So we ended up, after a period of about 18 months, we ended up, the Irish, in charge of the negotiations and in charge of the final diplomatic conference to negotiate the whole thing. And I was the ambassador in Geneva, so I was effectively president of the chairman of the diplomatic conference, which was held in Crow Park to outlaw cluster munitions. And I had a great Irish team, five people, including myself, and another from Geneva, and three from Dublin, from Foreign Affairs, and two from the Army, including a fellow called Colonel Jim Burke, who was a renowned military expert on demining, deactivation, decontamination, that sort of stuff. And so we had effectively a 10-day negotiation in Crow Park. We took, frankly, a lot of risks. Micheál Martin had just become Minister for Foreign Affairs a couple of weeks beforehand. Dermot O'Hearn had moved on, I think, to justice. And I had breakfast with Micheál Martin on the day the conference opened. And I said to him that I thought, because we had done a huge amount of work, the Irish side, I thought we had a good chance of getting an agreement to outlaw cluster bombs among states. And that we had a good chance that we get the International Committee of the Red Cross, who are responsible for international humanitarian law, and the United Nations to agree. But I said we would not be able to fulfil the desires of all the Irish NGOs, because they effectively wanted to ban everything, and I just didn't think it was feasible. So I said to him, if I get something that the UN and the International Committee of the Red Cross can agree to, can we accept that? He said, yes, go for it. That's what we did. And it's the biggest piece I ever did in my life.
Bigger than the Anglo-Irish stuff?
Cluster munitions is very important, yeah.
Though, throughout your diplomatic career, you had the support of a wonderful wife and friend, your wife Antoinette. Now, as we speak, she is in care in a very good care centre, I think, in Shankill. At what stage did she begin to develop dementia?
In Geneva. And it came very slowly. But by the time I retired, when we were both 65, and we came back here, I went to the Institute for International and European Affairs, and I realised after a few years that I just couldn't leave her alone, and that was in 2013. So I had to give up to the institute, which I really enjoyed, because you know she was wandering, and one time she was to go and look after our grandson, and I ended up discovering that she'd driven a car 170 kilometres and she'd no memory of it at all. So it's a, yeah, it's a, she's lucky, she's in a very good place. It's John of God's, St. Joseph's in Shankill. The only people there are people with dementia, specialised in dementia. It's a wonderful place. She's comfortable, she's happy.
How frequently do you visit her?
Every second day. I get very little reaction now. She has no physical capacity, and she rarely opens her eyes and she rarely says anything, but she is actually alert. You know, she knows what's going on around her. And the visits, visiting people with that condition actually do make a difference.
How do you know?
I tell you, there's a Polish woman is one of the people who looks after her. They change the carers every so often. One of them is Polish. And she said to me one day as I was leaving, she says, "We always love you coming in here." And I said, "Why?" "Because she's always in such good form when you leave." That's how I know.
That's a lovely thing for you to hear.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's important, I think, for people in situations similar to mine, and there are very many, there's, what, 50, 60,000 people with Alzheimer's, that visits, even though you might get no response, that the visits actually do make a difference.
Something else in your life, and I think this would come as news to people who don't know you or maybe don't know you that well. You've got a lifelong interest in motor cars.
Some people call me a petrol head. Yeah, when I was young, I used to, there was a very, very well-known rally driver called Larry Mooney. And I used to go, when I was young, rallying with him and occasionally help him navigate the car a little bit. And then when I retired, I sort of went back to it, and I'm interested in old cars. What I think most people would call bangers.
Well, there's one particular banger which I think you acquired, and it entailed a rather long journey, certainly the long journey home, and probably worth the trip. Tell me about that car.
Yeah. There was an Irish man called Brendan Bracken. His father was one of the seven founders of the GAA, and he was an exceedingly difficult child. His father died, and his mother brought him up to Dublin. He got kicked out of O'Connell's, he got kicked out of Mungret in Limerick, and eventually he ended up in Australia with an uncle who was a Monsignor or something in Australia, and he went AWOL, and he was gone for a year, 2 years. Anyway, he turned up at the age of 19, in 1919 in Britain. And he went to a private school. I don't know how he paid for it. And he spent one term in a private school. And at the age of 24, he ended up on the board of Eyre and Spottiswoode, the publishers. And they had two cash cows. They were the publishers of the St. James's Bible, and they were the publishers of the Book of Common Prayer. Now you can imagine how much money you made out of that. And by the time he was 29, he was elected to Parliament. His name was Brendan Bracken. And he was a great supporter of Churchill. He was Churchill's gopher all the time. He ended up owning The Economist. He was an extraordinary influential journalist. He had a newspaper called The Financial News, which was, I mean, as a journalist, he was very, very rigorous, very. And he had a motor car made for himself in 1935, a special Bentley with a special body. And I found the car in Vienna in 2018. And it's the last long journey I made with Antoinette. We drove it back from Vienna to Dublin, and it's Brendan Bracken's motor car. And if you sit, he didn't drive himself. If you sit in the seat where he would be, which is diagonally across from the driver in the back, you just, because he was a huge, big, heavy man, you just sink down into the seat. And the letter in the book of letters between Churchill and his wife, Churchill writes to his wife that he was off to a funeral with Brendan in his motor car.
So therefore, anybody who sits in your car in the passenger seat is sitting where Winston Churchill sat.
Yeah. And Bracken ended up as the owner of the Financial Times and Minister for Information in the British government during the war.
The Financial Times?
He ended up... Bracken House is the headquarters of the Financial Times. I can tell you how good a businessman he was. He bought the Financial Times in 1945 for $500,000, and it made a profit of 470,000 in its first year.
How do you feel about taking that car out onto the road, given its historical significance?
Well, it's the engine's being rebuilt at the minute, so it hasn't been out for a while. I love driving it. Actually, he had a nephew called Brendan Bracken, whom you may well have known. He used to work from time to time. He worked for an advertising agency.
And was he with Irish Life for a time?
That's right. Mm. That was his nephew. And I brought, the last time I had that car out before I had to start working on the engine was to drive Brendan Bracken in that car down to Hunter's in Wicklow and back. He lived in Torquay. He's died since.
I look forward to going for a spin with you. Forgive my presumption.
You're very welcome.
For an invitation.
You're very welcome.
But look, a few words briefly about your other interest, hobby-wise, ornithology.
I enjoy watching a few birds.
Is that a lifelong interest?
Always. I was always interested in birds, yeah. And, I live in Dunleary, and if I go for a walk down the pier or I go for a walk around the 40-foot, I always have a binoculars around my neck. And I try to get away about twice, three times a month, generally to South Wexford to watch birds.
The Salties and places like that?
I go to Salties. I don't go to Salties all that often, but I try to get to the Salties once or twice a year. Mm. And one of my grandchildren has got the same passion, and he loves going to the Salties, particularly as it gets him out of school.
Well, I'm sure you're more than happy to have his company, Dahi. Look, before we finish, I'm just interested in your take on the state of the world, as we say, in the first quarter of 2026. We're certainly living in interesting times.
Well, I think we're living in very difficult times and very unpredictable times. What's happened, for example, with the Russians is terrible. The invasion of Ukraine in 2014 and now the war for the last 4 years is just, it's a horror. The Middle East, the Hamas attack, and then what's happened in Gaza, what's happening on the West Bank, the unpredictability in America, the manner in which the administration has been taken over in America, manner in which the judiciary has been taken over, the use of ICE in Minnesota. It's terribly reminiscent of what happened in Germany in 1933.
You're not suggesting, or are you, or no. Is it a fear that things could take a similar course?
No, I'm not. Well, you never know what's going to happen. I think democracy has a sufficiently strong hold in the United States. You can even see it now. It's beginning to have an effect. But we really are living in very difficult times. And we in Ireland haven't escaped this. I mean, think of the attack on the health service, the cyber attack on the health service a few years ago. Think of, the Russian intention to try and keep Irish ships out of Irish waters a few years ago. And the people who told them to leave were the fishermen. We really are living in difficult times. And we're not in the same space now that we might have been 50 years ago. We're part of the European Union. The European Union has been exceedingly helpful to us. For example, during Brexit, you and I are old enough to know how poor this country was in our generation, even more so in our parents' generation. That's changed. Now, not saying that we don't have difficulties, but it has changed hugely. And I think for two reasons. One, the universal access to education, which was a tremendously fine decision taken by Irish governments, and it continues. And the fact that membership of the European Union allowed us to do in Ireland what previously Irish people could only do when they emigrated.
And to end maybe on a positive note, Dathi, your current, if you like, active public service pro bono, chairing Innovate for Ireland, a global talent development programme. What's that all about?
We're trying to encourage PhD students to come to Ireland from abroad, or indeed from within Ireland as well, to work on innovation and sustainability so that we can build up a cadre of people who've been through Irish universities and who can form a bond together, a bit like the Rhodes Scholars or a bit like the Fulbright Scholars or a bit like the Rhodes Scholar, you know, this type of thing. The first tranche is, we're hoping to get 50 million in the first tranche, and the government has committed to give us 50 million to match that. We've promises at the moment now of just over 30 million, and it's beginning to look reasonably good. The first group of students worked last year, and we're recruiting for another group this year.
You are, to borrow that phrase used by Charles Haughey when he was leaving Dáil Éireann, doing the state some service. Dathi O'Kelly, what an interesting conversation it's been. Thank you so much indeed for joining me on the Insights podcast.
Thank you, Sean. Very nice to be here.
And you can find more Insights with Sean O'Rourke on the RTE Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.